Okay, so this is an explorations course on particle physics, and I'm going to cover specifically dark matter. And dark matter is fun and interesting, at least I find it fun and interesting, because it connects all kinds of different aspects of fundamental physics. It combines elementary particle physics with cosmology, and it also gets into, I don't want to say more mundane things, but it actually gets into a bit of astrophysics, a bit of experimental detector physics, a bit of underground physics, and I'm in the dark matter game because I'm interested in learning about elementary particles. This might be a great new way to learn about elementary particles, but at the same time, I found that while I've been working on dark matter, I've also learned a lot of stuff that I wouldn't have learned otherwise, like how stars work in detail, or how what a globular cluster is, or what a dwarf spheroidal galaxy is, or this and that. And it's kind of a fun topic just because it combines a lot of different fields into one. And hopefully it will also illustrate, for those of you who've taken courses on the Standard Model or beyond the Standard Model, first of all, the limitations of the Standard Model, but also some of the ways that we are trying to learn about stuff beyond the Standard Model. So one of our best ways is the Large Hadron Collider, but another set of tools is looking for dark matter. And I guess the key part about dark matter, at least as far as I'm concerned with my particle physicist bias, is that we have this wonderful Standard Model that seems to be checking out at the LHC. You take the Standard Model, you apply it to cosmology, it doesn't work very well. It works terribly. There's all kinds of stuff it doesn't explain. And one of the things it really doesn't explain is dark matter. Now, it doesn't explain dark energy, as you've probably all also learned. Dark energy is a really hard problem that I don't want to get into. The answer to dark energy could very well be something to do with quantum gravity, whereas dark matter, it seems very likely that the answer is just some kind of new elementary particle. So I work on elementary particles. I find gravity very hard and confusing, so I'm going to concentrate on the dark matter part. Okay. The other thing is, please interrupt me. Please ask questions or bug me or tell me I'm saying something incorrect. Okay. It might take me a little bit of time to get used to these. I did this course last year and I had these all figured out, but they just changed it. So. Okay. So. The first thing I want to start off with is to try to tell you why you should expect dark matter out there. So I'm going to start off with evidence for dark matter. And since writing dark matter all the time gets tedious, I'm going to abbreviate it as just as DM, so no biggie. Okay, so the thing with dark matter, and the reason why there's a really compelling dark matter story, is that we have lots of different pieces of evidence, lots of different observations over lots of different length scales that all point towards the seeming fact that there's a lot more matter out there, matter in the universe cosmologically, than what we can see. So we see some amount of matter, and we see the matter that's there because it gives off light. And there seems to be much more matter than that, however, and the missing matter is what we call dark matter. So our probably best single piece of evidence for dark matter comes from the cosmic microwave background. So if you remember back to your cosmology course, the cosmic microwave background, or CMB, this is the residual roughly 2.7 Kelvin background photons sitting around. If you like, it's the remnant photons from the Big Bang. You started off with a very, very hot early universe. This universe expanded, it cooled, and what's left over from the cooling is some photons, and it turns out that these photons have a temperature of about 2.7 Kelvin today, and you can take your microwave telescope, point it at the sky, and you see these photons. So that's great, but you don't just point your telescope at the sky and see one temperature. You see little fluctuations in the temperature. So the temperature you measure is almost exactly the same everywhere. And this in and of itself is a bit of a puzzle, why it's so uniform everywhere. And this is one of the pieces of evidence for inflation. But even so, there's still small fluctuations on this. And the small fluctuations on this, I'll write it as delta t over t. These are roughly on the order of 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5. So very small fluctuations. So a very uniform temperature, but with small fluctuations. And you look at the small fluctuations, and these small fluctuations are, I don't have the picture, but you've all seen the picture of the CMB sky with the little warm spots and cold spots and so on. And you can look at the relative sizes of those warm spots and cold spots, essentially the average size of how big the warm spots are, how big the small spots are, and there's actually a lot of information in that. And the information in that can be usually expressed as a temperature power spectrum. So this is, you write it as CLs. So or I guess L plus 1 CL. And again, I'm sure you saw this in your cosmology course. There's this pattern of bumps and wiggles and so on. So this pattern corresponds to essentially a map of the typical size of the fluctuations. And this pattern that you get from observation, so here I've drawn a line, but you actually have data points that go all the way out, for pretty far out. And the thing is, this pattern specifically depends very sensitively. Yes?
What is the x-axis and what is the y-axis?
Sorry, I should have labeled this. So along this axis is L. Yes. So I should have written this down. I guess it wasn't covered in cosmology class.
I wasn't.
You weren't sitting on it.
Briefly.
Do you know what L stands for?
So if you like, we're looking at the sky, and we're looking at these spots, and the typical size of the spot, the delta theta, the separation between, let's say, two hot spots or two cold spots, the delta theta goes roughly like 2 pi over L. So you can do a measure of the relative two-point function, if you like, the correlation function between two hot spots or two cold spots, and look at the relative distribution, and plot it out, and you get a pattern like this. So the location of this first peak, for example, tells you that the total energy content of the universe corresponds to 1 in a certain set of units, meaning that there's no spatial curvature. But I guess the thing I want to point out here is that this pattern of bumps and wiggles also depends on the relative fractions of dark energy, dark matter, and baryonic matter. So from this pattern of bumps and wiggles and putting the data together and combining it with other stuff, I can get a measure of the contents of the universe. So the total density is roughly 1.0023 plus or minus 0.0055. And what I mean by these omegas is for each kind of energy density in the universe, I'll call it omega I. For each kind of energy density for the I species, so dark energy or dark matter or baryons or radiation or what have you, I have some energy density. And then I divide this by the so-called critical density. So the critical density is the density, the total density of matter if you have essentially a spatially flat universe. And this ratio gives you the relative fractions of all the components. So the total for everything that corresponds to the location of this first peak comes out to be 1, plus or minus error bars. But I can also do the same thing for dark energy. And for dark energy, I get roughly 0.73 plus or minus 0.02. I'm sensitive to the total amount of matter. And this total amount of matter, I'm going to look it up, but it's roughly 0.25. And then I have some amount of baryons, and it's roughly 0.0 0.05. This is probably closer to 0. So never mind the error bars. So these contents add up to basically 1. But the point is, I have some density of matter and some density of baryons. So what I mean by baryons, baryons means essentially anything that's visible. So if you think about the stuff that we know of, that we're familiar with, that's also stable on cosmological timescales, we have essentially electrons, neutrinos, and protons, and possibly some light nuclei. So of that, all that content is dominated by the stuff that happens to be baryonic, so the protons and light nuclei. So when we say omega baryons, this technically includes things like electrons that also contribute, but it's almost completely dominated by baryons, so we call this the baryonic density. So this is stuff like hydrogen gas and helium and stars and all that. So what's going on here? So first of all, these relative energy fractions are sensitive to, this pattern of bumps and wiggles is sensitive to this relative fraction of energy contents. Because each of these components have a different effect on how the fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background, first of all, behave, and how the light from them comes to us. And the point is that if I start varying the matter density, I would get a different curve. And in my notes, I have some, I show how the curves can vary with this stuff. But the upshot of all this is that this is the piece I want to emphasize. We have some matter density, and omega b corresponds to baryons. This is essentially all the visible density. And very obviously, the total matter minus baryons my total matter minus the visible matter is non-zero. So I need to have more matter than I can explain. And more matter than I can explain is what I call dark matter. So this is the first piece of evidence. Now, I've cheated a little bit. It turns out that there are different ways to fix these parameters and to get the same set of bumps and wiggles. So if you like, there are degeneracies in fitting these parameters to this curve. But there's actually complementary data from looking at supernova. If you look at supernova, which are very old, this tells you how the universe has been expanding in the last little while. And there's also another property called, another phenomenon called baryon acoustic oscillations. And you put all this data together, and the supernova and the baryon acoustic oscillation data removes these degeneracies and fixes these densities to with very, very low error bars. And you're really put into a position that you need much more matter than you can see. So this is our first piece of evidence for dark matter. I should also emphasize that this cosmic microwave background stuff corresponds to essentially the whole size of the visible universe. So this is really, really large length scales. So over these really large length scales, we have evidence for dark matter. I'm also going to talk about some other pieces of evidence for dark matter, but over much, much smaller distances. So one of the other quirks, or I shouldn't say quirks, but one of the other things that makes the story compelling is that here we have evidence for dark matter from very, very large length scales, but we also have evidence from dark matter over much smaller length scales, all the way down to the size of galaxies. So I'll get to that next. But the fact that we need dark matter between galaxies to clusters of galaxies to superclusters all the way up to the whole Hubble radius is a strong piece of evidence that this dark matter story, there's really something to it. Okay. That's what I want to say. Okay, so this is our first piece of evidence. So I'll call it evidence A. Our second piece of evidence comes from smaller astrophysical systems. And let me start off with, in some sense, a much smaller length scale. And that is galaxies. So everybody knows what stars are. Galaxies are just a cluster of stars that are self-gravitating. So a galaxy is a bunch of stars that are held together by their mutual gravitational interaction. And for many galaxies, it turns out that many galaxies, including our own, the Milky Way, many galaxies have the form of essentially a flat disk. So here, for example, is a cartoon of our own galaxy. So you have essentially a very flat disk, and there might be kind of a bulge in the middle where you have a bit more stuff. So this is a flat disk. So this is the 3D view. The cross-sectional view is like this. So I'm looking straight on onto the galaxy. This is a straight-on view, and then kind of the top view is kind of roughly circular, and here's the center. So this bulge is what we call the right in the center is the galactic center. This thing is the galactic bulge, and this is the disk around it. So for us, in our Milky Way galaxy, we're kind of out over here, and this disk is rotating around. And it turns out this kind of galaxy is a relatively common type. And for our own galaxy, well, because we're inside our own galaxy, it's a bit hard to observe. But we see lots of other galaxies like ours that are rotating like this. And what you can do with these rotating galaxies is if you point your telescope at them essentially head on like this, because they're rotating around this way or that way, light coming from this side will be light coming from stuff on this side will be coming towards you, and light coming from stars over here will be moving away from you, and that means it gets Doppler shifted. And by measuring the Doppler shifts, you can map out what the velocity distribution is along these arms. So in other words, you can map out through redshifts, the rotation velocity as a function of the radius from the center of the galaxy. So in other words, this is the distance r from the center of the galaxy. This thing is rotating around. And from the redshift, I can tell that this part's moving away with some velocity. And over here, it's moving towards you with some velocity, or vice versa. So now that we have v of r, we also know we can also estimate how much matter there is just from how much light stuff is giving off. So typically, the amount of visible stuff, the amount of baryons in the galaxy is proportional to how much light's coming off. And what we can do is make a plot of this velocity, v of r, as a function of the radius from the center of the galaxy. And this is something that's not very hard to compute. You can compute it to a pretty good approximation in these systems just using regular old Newtonian mechanics. And what you find is, well, what you would predict based on the amount of visible matter is that the rotation curve v of r should kind of rise up and then fall off. So this is what you predict. Visible matter, but when you go and make observations, you get something very different. For observations, the observation matches what you predict pretty well on smaller radii, but as you get out to larger radii, typically these curves flatten off. So in these rotating galaxies, hundreds and hundreds of these things have been seen, you find that the speed of rotation that you see is much larger than the speed of rotation you predict for the amount of visible light. Now this is a second piece of evidence that you need more matter. So typically, the more matter you have, yes?
Is this just for the spiral galaxies or for all galaxies?
This is for spiral. So simply because they're the ones rotating and they're the ones that lend themselves to this kind of observation. Now, even though these things are flat, suppose I cheat a bit and pretend I have a spherical distribution of matter. then this kind of prediction is trivial in that case. So this kind of prediction in that case, R squared. So just in regular Newtonian gravity, assuming a spherical distribution of matter, this is what I would predict for my rotation velocity. So what I want to get at here is this m less is the total mass within the radius less than r. And the point is that as I crank up this mass, I get more rotation. So the fact that my observed rotation curve lies above the predicted one based on visible matter corresponds to the fact that I need more matter in it to explain the rotation. So typically, the more matter, the faster it rotates. So this is our second piece of evidence for dark matter, that you need much more matter within these galactic systems to explain the rotation than you can account for based on what you can see. And now these galaxies are, well, compared to the size of the Hubble radius that applies to the CMB, these galaxies are really tiny. So all the way from this much smaller system to this very big system, we have evidence for dark matter. Now, beyond just galaxies, so as I said, galaxies are clusters of stars self-gravitating. It turns out that you can also have clusters of galaxies. Yes?
So there are no corrections from GR to this picture? No significant corrections?
I don't think they tend to be very large in this case, as you go far out.
It's very flat.
Yeah, but in any case, people know how to compute them. And they've been looked at, and that's not the source of the discrepancy. But typically, I think for these systems, away from the center, just regular old Newtonian works pretty well. Okay, so this is a single galaxy. But you can also have galaxy clusters, where lots of galaxies are also self-gravitating and holding themselves together. So if you like, a galaxy cluster is a galaxy of galaxies. Let me just try to get this. So this is a galaxy. You can do the same thing for galaxy clusters. And again, a galaxy cluster is just a galaxy of galaxies. And galaxy clusters, they tend to be messier. So you don't have a nice disk. You don't have a nice rotating disk. But what you do have, and what you can do, is look at average properties. And if you look at the average properties, you could look at the average speed of a galaxy cluster, sorry, of a galaxy within a galaxy cluster, moving within the galaxy cluster. And you can look at the typical distance of that galaxy within the galaxy cluster from the middle of the cluster. And what you expect on average, and this corresponds to the virial theorem, is that v squared should go roughly like gm over r. So again, this v squared in this case is a typical average velocity of a galaxy within a galaxy cluster moving around. This r is a typical size, or a typical distance of a galaxy cluster from the middle, so kind of the size of the galaxy cluster. And this m corresponds to the total mass within the galaxy cluster. Now, it turns out that you can measure this just by eye. You can measure these v squareds from looking at X-ray emission of hot gas and other things. And the upshot of this is that in galaxy clusters, you also need more mass than you can see. That that just based on the amount of visible matter, you don't satisfy this relation that you would expect to hold on average. And again, you can do this for lots of galaxy clusters. And the upshot is this. To be bigger than just visible. And one further thing about this, just sort of a historical anecdote, the first person to actually propose dark matter was a fellow named Fritz Zwicky, and he did it based on this kind of observation back in 1933. So people have been talking about dark matter for a long time, I think when Zwicky proposed it, people said he was nuts, or either nuts or didn't know what he was doing. But his predictions have actually been confirmed by all these other observations. So I'm just mentioning that in passing. Apparently Zwicky was quite the character, but I don't have any good stories for now. Okay, now there's one other way to look at galaxy clusters. And this is sort of a special case that works particularly well. And there's something called the Bulla cluster. And you've probably seen the pictures. And I have the picture in my notes, but I'll try to give you a quick sketch. So the Bulla cluster is actually two different galaxy clusters colliding, or at least the aftermath of their collision. So the idea is that suppose this is my galaxy cluster 1, this is my galaxy cluster 2, this galaxy cluster is moving this way, this one's moving this way, and they're moving together. And for these galaxy clusters, you can measure the stuff in them in two ways. You can measure visible matter based on X-ray emission. So the visible matter is going to accelerate hot gas that gives off X-rays, and you can measure the amount of visible matter through the X-ray spectrum. On the other hand, you can measure the total amount of matter within these systems through gravitational lensing. So in other words, these galaxy clusters sit between some stuff behind them and us. And as the light from the stars behind the galaxy clusters goes through the galaxy clusters, it gets bent and twisted. And you can use this to map out the matter distribution within the galaxy cluster. So the Bulla cluster, the before situation, is something like this. The after situation, let me get some colorful chalk to try to emphasize this. So before, I'm going to use blue for I hope the color's coming up back there. I'm going to use blue for the total matter. Sorry, I'm just messing up the board here. I'll use blue for total matter. And then so I've got some total matter here. And then I also have some visible matter that I measure through X-ray emission. And I'm going to use the orange chalk for that. So I've got some orange stuff here. And we're pretty sure that before the collision, the total matter and the visible matter just sat right on top of each other. They weren't separated at all. OK, great. So this is the before situation. The after situation is pretty different. So the after situation, and by after, I mean after these two galaxy clusters have collided with each other. The after situation looks something kind of schematically like this. So the total matter is kind of out here. And there's some kind of junk in between. But most of the total matter seems to have just passed right through. So suppose I put like a little spike here to say that this is one side and that's the other side. The point is this spike is over here. So this cluster has gone through here. This cluster has gone through here. So now here, this guy has gone over here, and it's still moving away. The other guy's moved over here, and still moving away. And this is my total matter. On the other hand, if I look at the visible matter, the visible matter is now separated from the total matter. So the visible matter that I see through X-ray is kind of out in the middle here. So what we seem to find in the Bulla cluster, after these galaxy clusters have collided, is that the total matter seems to have gone right through, but the visible matter has kind of glomped up in the middle. And you can actually see shock waves corresponding to what you'd expect by visible matter hitting itself and sort of bouncing off itself. So the interpretation of this is that the total matter is mostly something else that's not visible, and it doesn't interact with itself. So the picture is that the total matter, or most of the matter in the galaxy cluster, is this stuff that doesn't interact very much and just passes right through. Whereas the visible matter, stuff like baryons and like hot gas and electrons and all that stuff interacts with itself and kind of glumps together in the middle. So the bullet cluster is special because normally in these galaxy clusters, we expect to have the visible matter and the total matter and the dark matter to be right on top of each other. But in this case, because of the way the collision happened, they've actually separated. So the bullet cluster gives, if you like, kind of a snapshot of the aftermath of this collision, but where it's managed to separate the total matter, or I should say the dark matter, from the visible matter. Yes?
So do we know this from numerical seven simulations? We obviously don't see the dark matter.
Oh, no, but remember, we can map out the total matter from the gravitational lensing. So the point is that most of the matter, well, the visible stuff gets glomped together, which is what you'd expect for visible matter. Like it's some big, messy, ugly, complicated collision that you can't really compute, but you do expect some like stuff hitting each other. Whereas the total matter just seems to have breezed right through. So it looks like for this system, I've heard about the chalk, you also need dark matter. Okay. And the last thing, and I'll come back to this in a little bit, but if I zoom out even beyond galaxy clusters, not quite to the Hubble radius, but I'm getting there. If I look at the pattern of galaxies and galaxy clusters and so on over very, very large distances, it turns out that there's a pattern that kind of looks like a picture of, it's called filaments and voids. So the galaxies and galaxy clusters and so on form these filaments, and in between the filaments, like kind of little strings, in between these filaments are big pockets. So it looks like this kind of bubbly structure. And this structure, you can simulate it numerically. And to explain the filament and void structure, this kind of bubbly structure, you also have to put in dark matter to get a consistent story of this so-called large-scale structure. So I'll come back a bit later, to maybe today, maybe tomorrow, and tell you a bit more about large-scale structure. But for now, just keep in mind that there's another piece of evidence for dark matter from that. Okay. So I should also say that the class today is very qualitative. I'm going to get into hard equations and number crunching tomorrow. But for now, I'm trying to be a bit motivational for evidence. OK. One thing I also want to, OK. So anyway, we have evidence for dark matter. So let me just be specific about the dark matter hypothesis. Or if you like, a summary of all this in our interpretation in terms of dark matter. So to account for all this data, the dark matter hypothesis is that there exists some kind of new particle that is, so to explain this data, you need some kind of new matter that does three things. So first, and I guess this is fairly obvious, is that it should be non-luminous. And based on what we know about elementary particles, for something to be non-luminous, to be something, for something not to give off much light, it should be uncharged under electromagnetism. So it should be uncharged under electromagnetism and the strong force. So this is the first thing that we need our new particle to do. The second thing to account for this data, for it to act like matter, remember when I talk about matter in a cosmological scenario, what I'm really saying is just something that's non-relativistic. So under my dark matter hypothesis, non-relativistic. This new particle should be non-relativistic back to pretty early times in the early universe. And the third property I need, it should be very weakly interacting. Actually, weakly is maybe a bad word, but by weakly I mean just not very strong. I don't mean weak interaction.
So the strong force, why, what excludes the strong force? Is it non-luminosity? How is non-luminosity related to it being uncharged on the strong force?
Okay, well, if you're interacting with a strong force, you're going to interact in a strong way with quarks, which do carry electric charges. And that's going to give you a secondhand, effectively, an uncoupling. But even beyond that, if dark matter interacts a lot with itself at all, and it would if it was charged under the strong force. So by weakly, I mean feebly, not weak interaction. Dark matter should be weakly interacting with both itself and with visible matter. And there are various reasons for this, but one reason is sort of evident from here. If dark matter interacted a whole lot with itself, the total matter here wouldn't just pass through themselves. That's one reason. There's actually a stronger limit from the galaxies that I drew here for you are essentially flat rotating disks. But there are other varieties of galaxies that aren't so collapsed. And for those, they really force the dark matter not to interact very much with itself. So the dark matter hypothesis is that there's some new particle that satisfies, or I should say, there is some particle that satisfies these properties. And at this point, it turns out that the new is necessary because no particle in the standard model works for this. So in the standard model, if you think about the neutral particles in the standard model, well, I have the photon. The photon's obviously no good. It's obviously relativistic. All my fermions are charged, except for possibly the neutrinos. But we know that the regular neutrinos have to be very light. And the only other neutral particle in the standard model, well, you have the gluon, but the gluon doesn't work because, again, it's strongly charged. And you have the Z vector boson, but that decays. So I guess the particle should also be stable. But in any case, the upshot of all this is that one way to account for all this data, and this actually works very well, is that we just postulate a new particle with these properties. So this is how the dark matter story, all this cosmological and astrophysical stuff, ties into elementary particle physics. So this whole story is interesting, but for me as a particle physicist, this is where it gets really interesting. That it turns out that if I make a simple hypothesis that there's some new particle with these not too crazy properties, I can explain all this data. And I can explain all this data in a fairly simple way without having to do much work. Like the dark matter doesn't have to have any magic properties. It just has to do these fairly straightforward things. Okay. So I'm going to concentrate on this dark matter hypothesis, that there's some particle that does all this. And for the rest of the course, I'm going to look, with one exception, I'm going to look at what this implies, how to look for this kind of new particle, what kinds of particles have been proposed to make it up. So there are lots of possibilities. People have proposed stuff from supersymmetry, from extra dimensions, something called axion related to properties of the strong force, and lots of other things I'm not going to have time to get into. But just one quick aside. let me also mention that all this evidence for dark matter comes from gravitational effects. In the sense that all the stuff here, all the stuff that dark matter is doing in all these examples is just gravitating. In the sense that in the galaxies, it's just the gravitational interactions of the dark matter that's doing interesting stuff. In the galaxy clusters, it's the gravitational interactions. In the CMB, it's the gravitational interactions. So as far as we know, everything gravitates. And because we only have evidence for dark matter from gravitational interactions, first of all, we know basically nothing about its particle physics properties. other than these sort of generic features. The other thing is that because we only have gravitational influence, or gravitational evidence for dark matter, an alternative hypothesis to dark matter is that there actually isn't any dark matter. It's just that gravity doesn't work the way we think it does. So the way we think gravity works, as long as you don't get to too high of a density or too high of energy, it's just general relativity. So all this is based on regular old general relativity, classical general relativity. And as long as general relativity works, we really do seem to need dark matter. People have also hypothesized that maybe general relativity doesn't work quite so well over the very large distances concerned here. This is an interesting possibility, and people are doing research on it, and it's something that's definitely worth researching, but it's also really hard. And it's so hard that I don't know of a reasonable way to modify gravity in such a way to explain all this data. Whereas for dark matter, I just stick in a new particle with these kind of generic properties, and pow, everything comes out right. So my own bias is towards the dark matter hypothesis, but I do want to mention that an alternative that's completely logically consistent is modified gravity. I just don't know how to modify gravity to get this to work, and I don't know if anyone else knows either. Okay, so that's just an aside. I'm going to concentrate on dark matter's particles for the rest of the course. Okay, so we have this evidence for dark matter. When we go off and look for dark matter, it's going to be important to have an idea just how the dark matter is distributed. How it's distributed over cosmological distances, but also how it's distributed over things like much smaller things like galaxies. So let me come back to, so before I mentioned cosmological structure, this filaments and voids structure, if you like, just the distribution of matter over different length scales throughout the universe. And dark matter comes into the story in a very crucial way. Actually, I kind of want to leave that up. So the second thing I want to cover is distributions of dark matter. Okay. And for this, I want to concentrate on two things. I want to concentrate on distributions of dark matter over very, very large distances. And first of all, and second of all, over distances the size of galaxies, and specifically our own galaxy. Because our own galaxy, as you might expect, it's really the best or most promising place to look for dark matter, just because it's close by. OK, so for dark matter over cosmological scales, there's actually a whole story of how you go from a very, very uniform universe, a very, very uniform early universe, to the story we have today. So thinking back to the CMB stuff that I just erased, remember, if you look at the CMB is, if you like, a snapshot of the universe at Z of about 1100. So this Z is redshift. So you probably covered this in cosmology, but if you didn't, the Z roughly is the ratio of the scale factor today, so I'll put this T today, over the scale factor at some earlier time. So the bigger the bigger the redshift, so it's not quite this. I think it's this minus one or plus one. But oh, actually, in your cosmology course, did you use R for your scale factor or A? Does anybody remember?
A.
You used A. Okay, so people know what I'm talking about. You have your FRW. Your dF squared is minus dt squared plus a squared of t. Dx squared, people. Okay. So this is the scale factor, and the point is that we have some scale factor today, and the scale factor is growing, growing, growing. So as I go back to earlier and earlier times, the scale factor is smaller than today, and that means that this ratio gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So today, if I put t equal to today here, I get 1 minus 1, that gives me 0. So today is 0 redshift. But if I think back to very, very early times, this was much smaller than this, and I get some big number here, and I get a big redshift. So the cosmic microwave background corresponds to a snapshot of the universe at roughly this redshift. And the reason that occurs is that this is the epoch, this is the time in the early universe when free nucleons and free electrons came together to form neutral hydrogen and other neutral atoms. So in other words, this redshift corresponds to when you go from an early universe that's a plasma of charged nuclei and charged electrons bouncing around to a nucleus where you have neutral atoms. And when this happens, when you go from a charged plasma to essentially a neutral plasma, all of a sudden the plasma becomes transparent to photons. So a charged plasma, if I have a photon going along the charged plasma, it's going to hit a charged particle and scatter around, and my photon doesn't go very far. Whereas if I have a neutral plasma, the photon interacts much less with neutral objects, so the photon just goes along and it doesn't hit anything at all. So what happens essentially at this point is that all of a sudden the universe becomes transparent to photons, and the photons we see today as a cosmic microwave background are just the leftover photons that have traveled from this point all the way to us without hitting anything. So the CMB is really a snapshot of the universe at this early time. And remember, the fluctuations of the temperature of the universe were roughly 1 part in 10,000. So in other words, the fact that the universe was very, very uniform in temperature at this earlier time corresponds to the fact that the universe was also very uniform in density at this early time. So we start with a very, very smooth universe. And what we get today is something that's not smooth at all. If we look out today, I look over here, I see a galaxy. I look out over there, I don't see anything. So today we see much larger fluctuations in the density than we had at this earlier time. And the story of how this happens involves dark matter in a crucial way. And it's called structure formation. So the story of structure formation is that I start with this pattern of very small fluctuations. And in fact, this pattern of very small fluctuations is what you would expect to be left over from inflation. And in the inflationary story, these small fluctuations come from quantum fluctuations in the inflaton field that drives inflation. In any case, suppose I start with a region that is very, very slightly overdense. So I have some region that's a little bit denser than the surroundings. So this region, at early times, is going to expand as the universe expands. But as it gets bigger, it turns out that this expansion, this overdense region, as it gets bigger, becomes unstable against collapsing. So I think with Tiber, you'll cover an example of this in the tutorial. But the point is that the matter here, as it gets bigger, at some point it becomes unstable against collapsing on itself gravitationally. And when it collapses on itself gravitationally, you go from a small density fluctuation to one where everything collapses gravitationally and clumps together, and I get a much larger fluctuation. So for this kind of fluctuation to work, though, the stuff I need in this overdense region has to be non-relativistic. So in other words, the thing that drives the gravitational collapse is matter. If I have photons, photons don't collapse very well at all because they just zip out, they're relativistic. Whereas matter, it's non-relativistic, has a much lower pressure, and is much more susceptible to collapsing on itself. So the story with dark matter is that dark matter, it doesn't interact very much with itself, it has essentially no pressure. Dark matter collapses on itself gravitationally, and it clumps together into smaller clumps. And as it does, these smaller dark matter clumps pull in baryons. So I start with an overdense region of dark matter. This overdense region of dark matter collapses on itself gravitationally. And as it collapses on itself gravitationally, it becomes much more dense. And that forms a gravitational potential well. And that gravitational potential well pulls in baryons. And the baryons are attracted to the dark matter. And what I end up with is some clump of dark matter. And the baryons fall in and dump their energy. And what I end up with at the end of the day is some cluster of dark matter with some baryons inside. So I'm hugely oversimplifying this, but you can treat this in a quantitative way. And the upshot of this is that today we expect that visible matter basically tracks dark matter really well. So the story today is wherever we see a lot of visible matter, we think that it's surrounded by dark matter. Because of this picture where the reason why we have these clumps of visible matter, these galaxies and galaxy clusters, is that what happened in the earlier universe is dark matter collapsed on itself gravitationally, it sucked in the baryons went off to make stars and galaxies and so on. And since those baryons being sucked together is driven by the dark matter, and the things we see are the baryons in the forms of stars and galaxies and so on, we think that the pattern of visible matter should track the distribution of dark matter. The technical term really is trace. So people say that visible matter is a tracer of dark matter. And this is handy because it gives us an idea of where lots of dark matter should be. I should also say that if you don't have this density of very weakly interacting dark matter, the baryons wouldn't be pulled in the same way. And you wouldn't actually be able to explain the pattern of visible matter that you see. So I mentioned that structure formation was another piece of evidence for dark matter. This is essentially how it works. Dark matter acts like, if you like, a scaffolding upon which the distribution of galaxies forms. Okay, so the first bit is on galactic scales, supergalactic scales, very large scales, we think that dark matter, we think that visible matter basically just follows along and tracks the dark matter distribution. Now, if I zoom in to visible objects like stars and galaxies and so on, that's not quite the case anymore. So let me just get through this quickly. Find this. Ah, great, I have a clean board. Okay, so this is the story over very large distances. But there's a slightly more complicated story when these baryons clump together. So when dark matter comes in and collapses on itself gravitationally, it stays fluffy. And what I mean by that is dark matter comes in, but as it falls in and collapses gravitationally, it's self-gravitating, but it just passes right through itself and it will sort of oscillate and you'll get and things will orbit and so on. But on the other hand, as the baryons fall in, the baryons interact with themselves. And when baryons interact with themselves, they can collide with themselves and give off energy in the form of photons. And the fact that baryons can dump energy in this way, in the form of photons, means that baryons, as they collapse gravitationally, they speed up. But because they can interact with themselves and dump energy to photons, they can get rid of that energy. So on much smaller scales, like galaxies, we expect baryons to clump much more densely than dark matter. So this brings us to galactic dark matter. So the point is the visible stuff, the baryons are tracking dark matter up to a point until they get really dense. And when they get really dense, they dump even more of their energy as photons, whereas the dark matter can't. So the visible matter actually gets denser than the dark matter, at least in some regions. So this gets me to galactic dark matter. And let me start off with the picture of our galaxy. So our galaxy is a spiral galaxy. So our galaxy, viewed head-on, is essentially this flat disk with a central bulge. And the disk is rotating around, and we're kind of out in the arms over here. So that's us, and here's the galactic bulge. Now, what we think is going on with dark matter in our galaxy is that these baryons, the visible stuff in our galaxy, has clumped up a whole lot. The dark matter, though, because it can't dump energy in the same way, hasn't clumped up nearly as much. So we think the story for dark matter is that there's a roughly spherical halo of dark matter around our galaxy and about other galaxies in general. So this is the visible part of our galaxy. And we think that our galaxy and galaxies in general are surrounded by a halo of dark matter. So halo is just a technical term for this kind of big fluffy thing surrounding us made of dark matter. Now, there's a whole research industry trying to figure out what the distribution of dark matter is within this kind of halo. And the way people do this is something called n-body simulations. And an n-body simulation is exactly what it sounds like. You start with a system of n particles that only interact with themselves through gravity. You start with essentially a fairly uniform distribution, and you just let them evolve under their mutual attraction. And when this happens, these particles will attract, and they'll go through complicated orbits and this and that. But if you let it run long enough, if you're lucky, it'll reach a steady state. And the steady state is what we interpret as the structure of this dark matter halo. So I think I'm running out of time. Let me just show a good endpoint. So I'll come back to this in the next class. But the point is that the upshot, the result of these simulations, is that we get estimates for the energy density of dark matter. In our galaxy. And we also get estimates for the velocity distribution. So in other words, from these simulations, we get estimates for how dense this halo of dark matter is. And typically, the density falls off as they go away from the galactic center. And you also get estimates for the velocity distribution. In other words, if I look at a typical dark matter particle over here, how fast is it going on average? Yes?
So you call it a halo, but it's really like the whole, like it's everywhere.
Like, oh, yes, yeah.
It's not just on the outside.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, maybe that's a bad term. Well, halo is what people use. Maybe it's not the best terminology. In fact, we expect it to be densest in the middle. And I'll get to that tomorrow. And in this thing, you think of this as kind of a big fluffy marshmallow of dark matter, with a much denser dark matter, a much denser galaxy within it. So I think I'm out of time. I'll wrap it up there. But please consult the course wiki for my notes, which may or may not be at that URL. That's my email address. I'm still sorting out which office I'll be in. And feel free to drop by when you like. Or send me an email. And I guess that's it for today.